And we're back.
Welcome to No Direction Beyond, your Starfinder news, reviews, and interviews podcast. I'm Alexander Agunis, No Direction's everyman gamer, and I'm joined, as always, by the most intrepid Starfinder this side of the galaxy, which I guess we should call Desna's Way now. James.
I'm James. I used to write Code Switch.
And I'm so excited to be back. We had to push it back a week. We had a lot of like health things going on at the end of May. So we're here the first week of June. But more importantly, we're here with the first Starfinder hardcover book since Mechageddon. Galaxy Guide. I'm so excited.
I forgot it's been that long.
It's been a long time. Like, I mean, if you want to get technical, Paizo's Dustin Knight keeps joking with me that the Gap book came out since then, which is that like blank journal that you could have bought for April Fool's Day a few years ago. And of course there's the playtest book, but like a playtest book and a journal aren't like products filled with lore and things to do and adventures to have, you know what I'm saying?
True.
Yes. So very excited. Galaxy Guide is interesting. Obviously we haven't had the Starfinder core rulebook come out yet, right? Like, so we don't have any of the finished rules. There is content for Starfinder 2 second edition in this book, and you can play it if you had the core rulebook. So I guess if you wanted to use the playtest document. So like it's very interesting to see this book come out. What do you think, James? Do you think this is a case of Paizo putting the cart before the horse?
Maybe, but I think we're supposed to get other stuff pretty soon after this. And this book is really dense, and you'd probably need time to figure out what you'd even want from this book after you get through the playtest stuff.
Yeah, and I would say that like if a lot of the pre gosh, what was the name of that really awesome book? It wasn't Character Operations Manual, the Starfinder Enhanced. There we go. Mm-hmm. A lot of like the pre Starfinder Enhanced stuff was like three parts lore to one part like rules mechanics. This feels more like five parts lore and one part rule mechanic. Does that sound pretty fair to you?
Yeah, it's a big shift. It kind of reminds me of the Starfinder first edition, the little like softback rule setting book for the free RPG day when it was coming out. But it's like it's like here's the opposite of that, which is everything.
But I also think that that style makes sense considering they're literally putting this out before their game. And, you know, here we are. We've got this great little setting guide. So let's talk a little bit about the stuff that's in this book. James and I are going to go over the content. Typically, in typical review fashion, we're going to give our we're going to touch on all the different sections. We're going to give our opinions. We're not going to go super in depth, but we're going to talk about the stuff that really stuck out to us as like initial readers. And then we'll kind of just go from there and see what we got.
Yeah.
So when you buy this book, the first thing that you're going to see is that you have this really handy little, it reminds me of like from the Magic School Bus. If you've ever seen the Magic School Bus, like Miss Frizzle's like straight line, here are all the planets in a row. Mm-hmm. It's very fun. I like that. It's for the Pact World system. So you have all of the planets listed there, plus the diaspora, the asteroid belt that circles the star system. It also gives you like a brief little, like here's a one paragraph pitch for each of the planets in the Pact Worlds, which notably no longer includes Aukturn, the planet that exploded going into this this edition, and now includes Polonis, which is a new Pact World that just joined as part of second edition.
Which isn't in the Pact World at all.
No, it's not. It's in a completely different system, which is funny because one of the things it says it's located in the Gavaniska system. I didn't realize that the name of the Vesk star system was Ganviska. I thought it was just the Vesk system because the Vesk name everything Vesk whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's like naming your planet dirt, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Or maybe it's just the case that like the Patro were like, we're not naming our system after our oppressors.
True. You might want to Gulf of America that, you know, just we're gonna call it something else now.
Oh god. Yeah, so this book is separated into five sections. You have the introduction, you have adventures, you have Ports of Call, which notably was also the name of a book in first edition. You have factions, and you have ancestries, because it's not a new setting book without some new cool aliens that you can play as.
Yeah, that's actually where most of the mechanics in this book lie.
All of the mechanics. Actually, that's not true. There are backgrounds in this book.
Yeah, and then I think there's some stuff in the factions too, but a lot of it is concentrated in the ancestries.
Yeah, definitely. So when you start this book out, and like there's like a, in the introduction, it kind of gives you an overview of like what's been happening in the Starfinder solar system, essentially.
It gives you a timeline also, from like the beginning of the slightly pre-drift up to the current year.
Yeah, yeah, all the way from when the gap ends to the current year, which is cool. It's very simple. It's very broad strokes. You're not going to see specific events on specific planets for specific peoples. This is kind of just like the major things that you need to know that are happening. Kind of like how we're not going to talk about the same wars in America that they would talk about over in like Germany, but everybody would talk about World War One and World War Two for the most part.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of reminds me of like a Dragon Ball Z like run up, like how they did like on the last episode of Dragon Ball Z, except it goes back to the beginning of whatever arc that was.
Last Starfinder, last edition in the Starfinder RPG.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty extensive. I mean, there's some stuff that I had to kind of double check because a lot of the stuff happened in society and through adventure paths, and I just wasn't able to play later society.
Definitely. One of the things that you'll notice about this book, it starts immediately in the introduction section and carries throughout the entire book, is that there is a heavy focus on what types of adventures and plots that you can use in order to make your campaigns and write your adventures and set your stage in Starfinder, so to speak. It's definitely like, I would say one of the things that is different about this book compared to most other setting books I've read is that it is less gazetteer and it kind of feels more like travel brochure but with like story plots.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to put it.
Yeah,
I used to read a bunch of like encyclopedias and atlases as a kid, and they would often subdivide by like categories, and this book kind of went that way, like an atlas, like here's all this type of things, like the adventures are broken down into what, like horror, wild, fantasy. So they try to break it down so that if you're going through, you might go, oh, this looks interesting. Instead of just kind of going, here are planets. Here is planet one, planet two, planet three. It's a lot more kind of a free form adventure where you could skip a couple pages and get to something completely different and not feel like you missed anything.
Yeah. Lava Being in chat asks, does this book cover any of the moons and smaller structures orbiting planets in the pack worlds? I feel like the list was ever growing in 1E supplements. I also feel like that list was ever growing. The answer is kind of, not really, not a whole lot.
There's a lot.
You think so? I didn't think there was much information on a lot of stuff. James and I have different opinions on this book that we'll talk about more, but I think that makes for a more interesting conversation and review personally. You don't really want to hear Statler and Wolf agree with each other all the time. One of the things I want to touch on is there's this really cool map for the Desna's Path Galaxy in the book. I'm holding it up here on screen for those of you who are listening. James might be putting it on chat if we can get it rolling. We've had some issues. The other thing that's pretty cool is that if you buy this book, you get a copy of it as a poster. And I'm holding that poster now too, and I'm showing you the poster. So here's my thing. This is a really cool map. This looks like a kind of like retro sci-fi slash almost... oh my gosh, what's that name? XCOM. It looks like an XCOM style map. Like, it's cool. There's like hexes and cool symbols that's for stars, and then it connects to all the different planets and structures. I like this map. I'm holding this map as the poster. In the book, this is shrunken to a size that is so small that in print it is almost impossible to read anything. I do not like it in print. If you are going to reference this map, get a PDF or buy the book and reference the poster. The version that actually appears in the book, do not use it. You can't, unless you have like a magnifying glass, and even that might not work.
Your eyes are just old man.
You know what? Old man yells at clouds. It's true. I turned 36 last month, so I am ancient.
You're dust.
Crumbled to dust.
Yeah, on the PDF for the book itself, it splits it across two pages, top and bottom, but there is a map file in the...
Yeah, if you buy the PDF, you'll get a map file. You can reference that. It's much easier. In the PDF, it's across like a page and a half, like a page and a column. And so it splits really weird in the PDF when you're referencing it. Like, so don't try to read it in the PDF or in the book. Read it as God intended on either the poster or the poster PDF file. I think that is a problem for somebody who... picks it up and wants to reference the PDF, but I don't know that that's an earth-shattering problem. It's more like just a peeve for me. So take that as the fact that I'm saying that this is a small deal, but it does irk me. I'm allowed to be pedantic. This is it's half of what I do here. So there's also like a lot of really cool spreads. There's a beautiful art here of Dai and Chick. That's his name, right? The kid.
Yeah.
I think it's Chick Chick. I think it's Chick Chick.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, Elspeth is wearing his suit that I don't like in this edition, but he looks fine. His feet aren't in it, so I'm happy. So let's talk a bit about the adventure section, because that's kind of where this proleads into. This book does not follow what you would consider a traditional gazetteer style source book, does it, James?
No, not at all. It totally does, like, think of it like a Michelin guide where it goes by restaurant types.
Yeah.
It goes by adventure types.
Yeah, it's like a menu in a restaurant, but instead of like entrees, it's the vibe of the adventure you want. So there's a section about dystopian adventures. There's a section about high-tech adventures, fantasy, war-torn, into the unknown, horror, and weird. So there's a lot of different sections that you can cover in this book.
Yeah, and I think in a way, this is a helpful way to go about what you're looking at, especially if you're somebody who's new to the setting. Because if you're new to the setting and you look at that timeline doesn't make any sense to you.
Nope.
You don't know who those people are. And this book is not great to search through. Part because of how it's laid out, which is a choice that I think is made, and I don't think it's a bad one. I think it is just a choice.
As someone who has written books for role-playing games, I think that you have two choices when it comes to a book like this. Mm-hmm. You present it like a textbook. You give all the information about the place, mm-hmm. and you let the player kind of build how they want, mm-hmm. or you present the themes so that the players can look up what they want to do and then give them the tools to do where they want to do it. And this book, I would say that a more traditional book like Starfinder, the Pact Worlds, the first edition's equivalent of this book, mm-hmm. that is much more of a gazetteer style book where each section is split by planet. It tells you what's going on the planet, gives you all of its core stats like gravity and whatnot, mm-hmm. and boom, there you go. This book doesn't do that. This book takes every planet in the Pact Worlds and major places in near space and a couple in the vast and splits them by the type of story that you could tell there. And this has advantages and it has disadvantages, like James just said. You want to add more or you want me to keep going?
It seems like you're on a roll. Go ahead.
I am on a roll. Okay, I'll keep going. So, like, if you are somebody that, like, has never picked up Starfinder before, and you want to know, oh, I really want to tell this cool high fantasy story. Where can I do that? You can flip open to the high fantasy story section and you can read about Castrovel and how Castrovel is a world that's home to elves and a lot of magical structures and it's very green. Or if you want to run a high tech game, you can flip open to the high tech section and you can read a bit about the first ones of Avalon and what's going on with them and what their world is like. You can read about the world shards of Ashan, which is a place out in near space. You can read about about Avalon. Like, there's a lot of information, but if you need a place to set your adventure, boom, you go. This is not going to, what the section does not do well is it does not do well at providing you the facts about these places that you're visiting. Lava being in chat asked earlier if we got lots of information about like the different moons and satellites, and the answer is no, not really. If it's not a major place for an adventure, like if they don't have a major adventure hook in mind there, it can't be sorted into one of these places. It generally doesn't have information about it. James, we were looking through the book earlier and you were looking at Castrovel and we ran into something where we were just kind of like,
yeah,
you want to tell everybody.
So I do want to preface, I do think there's a lot of information about like the twins and what happened to them and all, how there's a lot of like moons that are now independent, Sarkeesians. Like, I think there is a lot more stuff there. It's not
the important places.
Yeah, it's I don't want to go to not important places. I can make those up. but we were looking through Castrovel and I was like, I don't remember what the four continents of Castrovel are, and it took me a minute to find that part in the book as well. And it definitely lists three of the continents of Castrovel. I don't think it actually lists the name of the southern fourth continent.
As a matter of fact, if you read this book, you would think Castroville only has one city on it. And that's not true. The original Pack Worlds talks about like five or six different major cities that are on it, on the planet of Castroville. And honestly, even that probably isn't enough to have like a functional society on a planet. Like, look at our world, like Earth. Like, granted, not every planet in Starfinder has to be Earth-like, but the number of cities on a developed planet of Earth-sized is immense.
Yeah.
And obviously you can't do that in a fantasy book. That is too much information for anybody to make, and you'll have too much overlap. Yeah. But the fact that you only hear about a couple places here or that is something that I would consider to be a weakness about this book. Mm. This is not a book to go to if you want a deep dive. And that's unfortunate because a lot of the information in this book is updated with information pertaining specifically to how things are rolling in the Pack Worlds and beyond in wake of all of the major setting changes that they've done going into second edition, like the birth of the newborn, or everything that happened as a result of Shaylin and Zonkuthon merging into a composite deity. Mm-hmm. You can't find that in first edition, but first edition is a more effective place now in order to find like broad strokes or like detailed geographical and sociopolitical information about these planets. Sure. So I think that it depends on what you're looking for. This book clearly is targeted for new people coming into Starfinder who don't know anything and just need a direction to start building adventures. I think that is fine. That is a choice. But if you're coming into this book and you want like major information about these places, don't be surprised when there's a lot of blanks that you're not going to be able to fill. This book doesn't have maps for most of the planets that are on it compared to first edition, which had a major map for every planet of the Pack Worlds, like a nice little spread half page for each of them.
I think this book covers such a larger amount of things that like they could have chosen to do just a couple, but they would have had to release multiple books of that destiny, and they might just focus that in later.
I would expect them to probably have a major like crunchy like more traditional gazetteer book up their sleeve. This book feels like the adventure equivalent of like a beginner box, but adventure books. Like, if does that make sense? Yeah. Like, this is for someone who doesn't know where to start in Starfinder.
I also think this is good for people that, because once again, most people have not played Starfinder. True. And if they did, they've played one or two scenarios. So this book is kind of a way to make them remember something that they might have played and give them more information about it to try to spark something there.
And that happens a lot. A lot of the stuff that they pick for these different stories in this book, they reflect major like campaigns, adventure paths that have happened, or major developments from society scenarios. To give two as an example, one that James found immediately and loved was City McCityface.
I saw that because I just hadn't played Later Society. I was like, I love this. Thank you, Zoe.
Yeah. And so then I had to sit down and I had to explain to James, like, oh, this was an adventure where Zoe actually sued the city of Zoe. And the outcome of that was that the mayor held the renaming to an election. This is all detailed in the book. But what's not in the book is that the Starfinder Society team actually had the players of Starfinder Society, like, they gave them like a list of choices and had them vote, and obviously they put City McCityface, and I'm sure they had to have known that City McCityface would have won for the meme
100%.
but like, that's the one that won. So City McCityface is a city that's like talked about as an adventure point when you talk about I believe that's Triaxis. That's Triaxis. So, like, there is stuff like that. Another example is under the War Torn section, there's major, I don't want to say major spoilers for the Attack of the Swarm adventure path, but one of the major like areas that they talk about is the system, the Suskalon system, from Attack of the Swarm, and like how things are progressing there, and it's still like on the forefront of the battlefield against the Swarm with like major changes because of what happened in that adventure path, and that's cool. And so like it does feel like a lot of the places that were chosen were like direct answers to, oh, these are main things that players returning may have done and how their actions shape the system, the setting, or these are things that like new players need to know.
Yeah, there's also a significant word count dedicated to Djinn Souls and what they've done since Cadrical got beat back. So I thought that was really, that part grabbed me a lot. I thought that was such a strong arc through the first two seasons.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, like the Scoured Stars has like several areas throughout this book that have major like build-ups and implications for like the stuff that happened there.
Yeah, and also the Gitteron Authority, and basically Space Nermothus and Space Nadal.
Yeah, essentially. Space Nermothus, and you're not wrong, Space Nermothus and Space Nadal are here. There's a whole bunch of stuff about Vesk 8 and Vesk 7, which is cool, because those are two planets in the Vesk system that didn't get a lot of attention in the original Starfinder Pact Worlds book. Mm-hmm. So because one of them is like a frozen ice waste planet, and the other, they kind of like orbit each other. And it's cool to see, like, oh, okay, you pick something maybe I haven't heard of before, but I know that's in the Vesk system. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I don't want people to walk away from this thinking of that, oh, Alex hates this, or James hates this. Like, we don't. It's different, and it has its strengths. The presentation has its strengths and its weaknesses. I don't think I'd want to see every book they ever do ever printed in this way. But I think that if the goal is to be able to hand a book to GMs and say, use this to help guide where, literally galaxy guide where in the galaxy you want to set the story with the tone you want, it's a pretty effective book at doing that.
Yeah, I would appreciate pronunciation guides. Like, I don't speak Nahuatl. I don't know how to pronounce that word.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to try. I can't pronounce that.
So now that we've gone over like a very, very broad strokes, why don't we spend a couple minutes highlighting our favorite edition in these adventures? Like, what adventure really stuck out to you? What did you think was really cool?
I enjoyed reading about, because I didn't get to do much of the Adventure Pass or later Starfinder side, that may have gotten into the war between the Vescarium and the the Star Empire, I keep forgetting their names, you know,
are we talking about the Aslanti Star Empire?
Yeah, Aslanti, that's it.
Okay.
I can't believe that word just want to come out of my mouth. Reading just about how, they're not as unified, and just the machinations of how the Vescarium versus how, the Aslanti Star Empire are kind of going about it. That was really interesting, because there was more there than I thought there would be about that topic.
Definitely. One of the things that I really like about this book is under the weird adventure section, there's a lot about Brithetta, like the gas, one of the gas giants that the, what are they called? The jellyfish people. I can't remember what the jellyfish people are called. The jellyfish ancestry is from this section. You want to help me, James? You remember? It's the one that Robin played. It was Jelly Fist.
Yeah, Brathus.
Brathus, thank you. Yeah.
Sorry, I coughed and I pressed the wrong mute button. I feel very silly now.
That's all right. It's now it's documented for posterity forever. or it's not. You get to choose. So the Brathus are, there's a lot of art of them in this book, because the section on Vithreda is relatively large, not because the gas giant gets its own section, but also several of its moons are also considered like weird worlds. That whole planet and its like lunars, like it's like planetary system is very much kind of like one of the weirdest places. But my favorite place in the weird section, and James, you know me, I love weird stuff. When we played Signal of Screams and I found out that you were actually a clone, I was so happy because it was weird, and I love weird stuff. It's my favorite. Anyone who plays in my Teenage Wasteland games knows that I love weird. And the weirdest thing in this book that's also very meme-y is the ghost levels of Absalom.
You mean the back rooms?
Which is basically the back rooms, but it's just like the lower decks of the spaceship. It's very cool. It is
an extra planar space.
Yes, it's a physical space on the ship, but that space is also extra planar. And so you could literally just get lost there forever. And it's exactly the type of thing that I love. And then you finish that, and then the next section is on my favorite weird place in Starfinder Society. It's Salvation's End. And yep. Salvation's End gets a whole write up here. For those of you who don't know, Salvation's End is like a recurring setting for first edition Starfinder Society scenarios. It's like this moon filled with like sciency, like research bays, where they're all researching different like behavioral cause and effect things, like from different cultures and societies. Nobody knows who built it. Nobody knows where it came from. And it's just weird every time you go there. And I love it. And it's here. And it's weird. And some of the weird stuff you do in society is here. And it's like, it's still weird. I'm like, ah!
Yeah, and also it's like Fallout, basically. Yeah. Where there's a bunch of vaults, including the clone of Joro.
it's like, what if Vault Tech, but planet?
Yeah, I don't know if you found, but they actually made art of Joro the clone. It's just later in the book.
Yeah. Well, that's because this is jumping ahead, but like one of the backgrounds is that it's a human only background and you just play a Joro the clone and it tells you what you have to look like because you're a clone. It's great. I love that.
It's so silly.
I also like
the art later. It was just like, what is that? Oh, he has a fanny pack. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So then after you finish with the adventure section, the next section in the book is called Ports of Call. These are important starship like ports in outer space that you can visit, important cities, major locations where people mingle. Obviously, the first one is Absalom Station. Sometimes I think that they made the main city called Absalom in both games because it would always be first alphabetically being AB. Which makes me want to make a city named AA just to push Absalom off the top of the list.
You could just be at Absalom Station.
Right, exactly. There's little stat blocks for all of the cities using the second edition stat block template for settlements. There's lots of information about different places you can go here, and there's lots of cool art.
Yeah, so you do get some of the hard information. It's just usually not for planets, and I think there might be a little bit for planets in the back, but it is less than for the cities.
Yeah, it's definitely, if you're looking for hard gazetteer style information, it's in the Ports of Call section on the cities. And even that is like maybe 4 pages, which I could be wrong, but I think the ports in Ports of Call got more than that, which again, it depends on what you're looking for. If you're a new GM who's never run this game before, are you going to want to look through 12 pages of gazetteer information to learn how to play? Or are you going to want a quick summary of 4 pages? Like I understand why it's presented like this, and it's probably the right choice overall.
I kind of think that way too, but you know, to each their own.
Yeah. The next section is about the Adari, which is good because prior to this point, there's not a ton of Kasatha art. And then this is the excuse to put those Kasatha in this book. There they are. So
I love the one in the military coat.
He's cool.
It just looks, he looks so he like Von distinguished Bismarck or something, you know?
Yeah. He gives you a vibe of a Kasatha, like an old world Kasatha society, like from like the original Kasath planet that wasn't just like a desert wasteland, like what they lived on like in Galarian during PF1 and PF2. He just got like a really good coat, and he's got like his cane and double swords, because of course you'd have two swords. He's got four arms. He needs at least half of those arms need to be armed in combat.
He has satchels. He has a shoulder pad. What are those
called? The ruffly ones, like that the prince in Little Mermaid always wears. You know what I'm talking about?
A name you can't pronounce. That's way too long.
Malukai oxen. Oh, there's no vowels. Yil. Yeah, that's a Y. Yil Fortu. I love it. And then the other one is one that's like staring at a tablet, which I also love them. They're wonderful.
I'd say what this book does really well, and I don't know how much of this art is reused, but there's so much beautiful art. It's almost worth it as an art book.
Yeah, there's definitely like it's got like vibes of being like a concept art book. Like you look over at the second city, which is right after the Adari. It is a ever-expanding region of industry influenced by dozens of societies. And very cool. It's a protocol for visits to a new location that's talked about in the book called The Absurdity. It's like this location where space is, it's kind of like if you read Galactic Magic, like where all of the singularities for like magic effects, there's like a weird singularity there that makes it so that like, I think it's drift doesn't work there. There's something that doesn't work properly there. Mm-hmm. But the second city is like on the outside of it. So if you're going to explore the absurdity, you go here.
Yeah. And then there's Starlance, which I think it's page 93 has art where it just looks like he's apparating as a hologram to start like a rap battle or do some slam poetry.
But it's a Patra. So it's literally like he's got threads you can enjoy and he's got a face that I can enjoy. It's great.
And there's just so many hype people around him. Like, I love this art. It's like not colorful. It's muted. But like just looking through all this, like I started just to share pictures with a group that I'm doing Cosmic Birthday for. It's like, hey, you don't need anything from this book, but if you're wondering what to do, look at some of the art here and you get some ideas.
I love that art because like that one, that so like the rest of the art looks like Starfinder, like the monsters and the guys around it going, oh, the aliens, like wearing more high-tech stuff. But that guy in the middle in like a t-shirt, a pair of jeans and some kicks, he looks like he's out of the Spider-Verse. This is like Miles Miles Meowlis. Meowlis, yeah. Which is the canonical, like, cartoon animal version of Miles in, like, Peter Porker's world. But that's what he looks like. He's great. It's like, and it looks like it's off a Nike's commercial. It's so cool. This is like, I'm glad you pointed this out, because, like, that piece of art on page 93 is literally my favorite piece of art in this book. And this book has fantastic art.
It's up there. The next page has just a jaguar or leopard, right? That has like a crew cut.
He's so cool. He's so cool. I love him.
I do like that they started to make a wider variety of Patra, because I feel like a lot of Patra art was pretty similar and kind of cartoony. And to start getting more realistic ones sounds weird to use.
Just look more like cats and not like weirdos.
yeah. I like both. I think you should be able to make your silly fantasy race look as silly as you'd like. But
I agree.
When I'm trying to get people into a game and they see only one style, and you tell them they don't have to be that style, that's still what goes in their mind. You know?
Did I ever tell you my headcanon for why Patra don't have tails in a lot of the art?
Why?
The Vesk made them cut them off for an oppressive thing. That is my headcanon. Nobody will take it from me. Mm. speaking of things nobody can take from you, your background, nobody can take from you. Yeah. The next section is talks about backgrounds after Ports of Call.
Yep, they're all split up into the different types of adventures again.
Yeah, and it's cool. Most of them are pretty, like, basic. You've got, like, bouncer, bartender. But, like, there are some rare and uncommon ones that are, like, a little spicy. And I like
the convict.
Yeah, and so the Dagox convict is a good one. I like Fisher. That one's funny. You're a fraudster who skillfully creates digital forgeries and manipulates information on InfoSphere. but then, like, obviously, we know the one that everybody, like, because there's the stuff like Scam Mage and Mask and Code Carrier, which are uncommon, and all of those are cool. But, like, you and I both know that the thing that we were very impressed by was Joro Clone.
That and also Ancient Illibrian.
Yeah, you're an ancient resident of Eox. You might have survived in Magitek stasis deep in a ruined necropolis, or you may serve as the trusted longtime attendant of an undying bone sage. You'd like to view modern life in the pack worlds with a mixture of amusement and contempt.
Like, that's just cool, because, like, through the first edition, you're just like, yeah, well, they should still be there if they're undead, and they're just like, it took until much later to get options, and now it's just a background.
Yeah. Very cool.
Also, Courier's wrong, because it's just about, like, actually moving stuff, and it's not just about being a thief.
That's true. That's true.
Every courier that I've known has been a wanton criminal.
I love this Patra, like, rebel on page 102, because he looks like he scavenged every piece of armor that he is wearing from a Vesk he killed.
that is one of the ones that I linked. I was like, look at this leopard man rebel in his pots and pans armor.
Yeah, right. It's very cool. It's like if somebody took the meme of that, like, that kitten with, like, a pot on their head, and but this is an actual, like, war veteran, a storied one too, because it looks like he's got a bunch of pieces from a bunch of different Vesk stuff. And like I said, he probably killed every Vesk he has a piece of armor from in order to make that suit.
Yeah, I love being in chat. So, are there art of any iconics from first edition that didn't make it into second, like Altronus or Keskadi?
I didn't see many. Most of the iconic art features Dai and Chick, to be completely honest. Sometimes a couple of the other iconics are in the piece with them, such as the Navasi, the iconic envoy, or Ilspeth. I can never say his name right, but the iconic Boom Boom operative. There you go. Obviously, the Technomancer and the Mechanic aren't in this book because they're not core classes and in the core Starfinder. And you also don't see, I can never remember the name of the guy who's the iconic Witch Warper, but the very cool guy with the high collar.
Yes, I forget his name as well.
Yes. I don't know. He's never made an impression on me the way that the other ones have. But also, he's not in the comic book. Fix that.
Zamir.
Gotcha. Zamir.
From Kitsune Warlock and Chat.
Good thing we've got a developer here to correct all of our pronunciations.
No, I mean, he gave us the name.
True. Let's see. Then we have Factions in the Galaxy.
Okay, Factions is a very strong part of this book.
Oh yeah, Factions are great.
Whoever did the tokens for the Factions really hit it on the mark.
Mm-hmm. Each faction has what basically looks like their brand symbol. Like if the G for Google or the arches for McDonald's. Abadar Corp is a pyramid. I love it. It's because
Yeah, because it's like on money, and then they have people in business suits fighting, and I love that. Like, it's so cohesive to like what you expect them to be, and it, like if you're just getting into it, you're like, oh, they're business people, but they're those business people.
Well, what's funny is that they're all called representatives. Like, none of them are like special agents. So you get this like this idea that like every single person on a phone call at a moment's notice could just flip open their briefcase and pull out a gun and start shooting.
It's time to accrue interest.
Time to get your severance package.
And then it goes down to the free captains, which is obviously Guardians of the Galaxy expired.
Yes. Their icon is a Patra, a very cute Patra holding a knife in its mouth. If you follow the Paizo's Twitter, it is the icon of the special edition version of this book. But it's like bright pink on that. It's very cute. This is where. So actually, one of the things that's interesting is each of these different organizations have a archetype that goes with it. For those of you who've played Pathfinder Second Edition, you'll know that an archetype is like a list of tiered feats that you can take instead of taking a class feat, or if you're playing free archetype, you just get. Mm-hmm. And it's very cool. The space pirate is the one that is associated with the free captains. It was also spoilered in several different places, but it is very cool because you can press gang people's souls. James and I have talked a lot about that one.
And also the art for the whole, all those people, like the free hacker, like it's all yeah. cute. And there's also yeah. like, I don't know, I think this is once again very like the Hell Knight section is like so great.
Yeah, it's very good.
Like it just like if you're somebody who is new and sees a Skittermander and you wonder what it would look like if it was evil, it's here.
Yeah,
it looks kind of stupid, but that's fine.
There's a Skittermander Hell Knight. It looks dumb, but it's the kind of dumb that fills my soul. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's dumb, but it is going to take your soul.
Yes. One of the things that I like is that the edicts, anathemas, and allies of the Hell Knights makes it clear that they are not nice people. So it's funny. Their edicts include protect the weak, but also suppress rebellion and uphold the law. They're basically hell cops. Which is funny because their allies include corporations. Okay, not great, but all right. Police forces. You guys are kind of hell cops, so that's okay. Allies, tyrants. Oh no,
just tyrants.
Yeah, not enemies are lawbreakers, pirates, and rebels. So like, are you the good guys here? I don't think so.
It kind of depends on where you start it, right? They're very unlikely to be the good guys, but depending on how bad your planet was before, they might be the good guys.
I'm sure many second edition Pathfinder fans are asking, is the Hell Knight archetype in this book compatible with the second edition one? This is a completely separate Hell Knight archetype. It is a Hell Knight dedication. It's called Hell Knight dedication. It is not the same. The feats are not the same. It's tailored for Starfinder. So if you wanted your GM to allow you to use the Pathfinder one, you can, but this one is its own thing. You do have orders. You can take an order. Would you like to belong to the Order of the Chain and punish lawbreakers? Maybe you'd like to belong to the Order of the Eclipse and control dangerous information. You can't see me if you're listening, but I'm putting quotation marks around the word dangerous.
I want to be part of the Order of the Crucible that gave Gitterons faster than light tech.
I know a lot of, I've heard of many, many people in government right now who would love to be part of the Order of the Pyre and purge subversive media with fire.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do like the fire part.
True. The next organization in this book is the Knights of Galarian, which they are always cool.
Yeah, that's, I mean,
just a fact.
I mean, yeah, I mean, they're your Iomedians. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the art is really cool. This Xeno, like Xenogears inspired piece.
Yeah, I love the Sheeran Knight of Galarian, where they have like crazy like hollow light wings behind them just to look even cooler.
It kind of looks like he's doing a Mercy from Overwatch cosplay.
He does. It's a Sheeran who looks like he's doing a Mercy from Overwatch cosplay. What I really like about him is that he's a Sheeran, which means he has never set foot on Galarian as far as we know. But man, he's here for the experience of being a Knight of Galarian because he's a Sheeran.
Yeah, I mean, we got to protect it. I mean, we have Absalom right here.
Yeah, but the whole archetype is really, like James said, it's based around like Iomede nomenclature. It's not a religious archetype, but you could abilities like Iomede's shield, Iomedae's sword, Iomedae's helm, and Iomedae's barrage. So just be prepared. You may not be religious, but your special attacks are named after Iomedae. So, you know, represent her well, or you're going to get vented out of the airlock.
And Starfinder Society? I don't know. I was about to say lastly, but
I think Xena Wardens are after that.
Yeah. Starfinder Society is, I mean, they have an Izalgun, and there's not very much Izalgun art, and I love Izalgun art.
It's very good. I love how the Izalgun is in the back, like, doing the mission objective while everybody else is fighting. That feels like many Starfinder Society scenarios I've played.
I just love Izalguns. They're big, stupid Gumby guys. I love them.
Yeah, well, I mean, you heard the news, right? That they're one of the ancestries that's going to be published in, like, the Starfinder, like, PDF, the guide to play. So, like, anybody can play an Izalgun.
That makes me very excited. I do.
I'm sure they'll get an official book. I'm sure they'll get an official book someday. But, like, the whole... It's one of, like, two or three. I think one of them is... I don't remember, but it was one that was very obvious. And I was like, oh, yeah. That one isn't one that we recruited, but... That makes a lot of sense. If anybody in chat who's listening wants to add the other two that I'm forgetting, please go for it. But talking about the society scenario, you don't really have any art of like major NPCs. It's kind of like side ones. But I do love Starfinder agent Zizeni because they have the coolest little hat on their head.
Zizeni.
Okay. That's on page 120.
Yeah, I was looking at the Isoki one, and I was like, that's Stuart Little looking one.
Yeah, the only thing I don't get is my book set up weird because like on page 118 is Starfinder Society. I flip the page and then it says you yearn to uncover the secrets of the past. Oh, that's Xeno Archaeologist. I thought it said Xeno Wardens. I'm just not reading. I'm sorry.
Literacy reading the skill issue.
Reading the archetype explains the archetype.
I would have guessed it's in the book.
But yeah, it's called I was expecting Starfinder Agent like in first edition, but it's actually just called Xeno Archaeologist, which makes more sense. That's a job. So you get stuff that lets you really good at makes you really good at like exploring new places, which is probably something the Starfinder Society cares about, considering their edicts are explore, report, cooperate. I love it. That's amazing. Like, I just want to say the fact that, like, because, like, edicts are supposed to be, like, the rules you follow, right? Like, these are, like, the guidelines for being a member of this organization. And, like, explore, record, cooperate makes so much sense. And they could have, like, gone really long and, like, given specific, like, things. But you don't have to do that. Starfinder players know that it's explore, report, cooperate. Why? You don't need anything else.
In that order. Slogan.
Yeah. Right. It's true. First, you have to explore. And then once you've done exploring, then you have to report. And then after all of those things are done, then you can cooperate if you have to.
Yeah, if you have to.
There's a priority system. It's like Paladin in second edition Pathfinder, right? Like the order of the edicts is from most important to least important. Cooperate is the least important one.
Yeah, like ingredient labels, you know? It's just like, yeah, we all did this, you know, through exploring and reporting, and we definitely put our names on the paper.
True. Speaking about people who probably definitely did things, it's the Xeno Wardens is the last organization in this one.
I do like that the front and center on the cover art, there's like an SRO, I guess that is, front and center for Xeno Wardens, which is just like, hey, your guy's a robot. They don't like nature. Yeah, they do.
he's like, no, look at me. I'm wearing so this is the other thing that I like. Of these, the only groups that have had like, unified drip, because like the Knights of Galarian had Mercy and then like Mecha Corps, and you had Starfinder Society agents who kind of just wear what they want while they're out. Like the only organizations that look like they wear matching drip are Abadar Corp and the Xeno Wardens, and the Xeno Warden drip is great. Like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that the Xeno Warriors had like game. What is this?
Yeah, no, it's striking. I think it's a good pattern. I mean, I would like to see one of them on a Raxolite. Just like a tiny, tiny little cartoon cloak.
Yes, very cool. All of the art in this section is pretty good. I think the Sandcat Patra's proportions are a little bit creepy, but I like it, so it's all right. It can be. I've met some weird people IRL, so like that's fine.
Yeah, we can have some weird looking cats. That's fine. This one and the one with the jaguar with the flat top can hang out.
Not every Patra can be the jaguar with the flat top and like Nike's beatboxing in space Miles Meowless man. like so some people just aren't born with game, and this Xeno Warden was like, you know what, I might not be born with the best appearance ever, but I can make a difference and protect the ecosystem by taking this mold and filling the computers with it until they explode.
And also put holes for my ears in my cloak.
Listen, you have to, though. You ever seen World of Warcraft? You know what it looks like when you don't have ears for your olds? Then you're just clipping.
I like clipping.
This one is very cool. There's a lot of the Xeno Druid archetype has a lot of abilities that build off of the Mystic's Mystic Bond class feature. So if you are a Xeno Druid, you basically have to be a Mystic still. Like, that is still something that's required of you, even though they aren't a dedication. But it is kind of like I can be a healer and then be a Xeno Warden. This archetype fascinates me because this feels almost like a prestige class. You have to be a Mystic to take it. It literally says you need the Mystic Bond class feature.
Yeah.
Very cool. I like this one. This one's cool. Yeah.
And then there's a bunch of minor ones.
Yeah, there's like the Akashic Society, the Aspis Consortium, the Corpse Fleet, Deep Cultures Institute, Eyes Wide Agency, Frozen Trove, Mechanized Adherence of Apotheosis, the Skyfire Legion, the Stewards, the Zenzir Mutations, and Zomedia. If you want to know more, you get about a paragraph from each, plus Edicts, Anathemas, Headquarters, Allies, Enemies, and Notable NPCs.
I like the Akashic Society. You're just like nerd on an astral plane.
I like that the Zyzer Mutations is in here because they were jerks in Fly Free or Die, and really? I'm happy to beat them up again.
So that's pronounced munitions.
What did I say?
Mutations.
Oh, well, that definitely changes the meaning of the word then, doesn't it?
We changed the word by spelling it.
We changed the word by pronouncing it correctly. So question, the next page for like the Ancestries 2-page spread, mm-hmm. Have you seen this one? Because I've seen on Reddit that people cannot stop talking about how caked the contemplative is on this page.
What? I don't go to those parts of these forums. I just don't. But now I have to look.
We'll let James take a minute to look at the contemplative and hear his official determination. James, for those of you who cannot see him, James made a face that said, "You people have low standards."
I don't need to say every thought out loud, but if you saw it, you saw it.
This one is very cool. It's got like a spread of all of the ancestries in this book at like a fashion runway type of event where you have, I think that's an Illyrian on center stage? I think it's an Illyrian, right? Or no, that's a... Is that one of the... I have no idea which one that is. But the you have... Apollo? Could be. I don't know who the dude that the contemplative is standing on is. That kind of looks like an Astrozoan.
Yeah, that's an Astrozoan.
He's shape-shifting to copy her face because he thinks it's pretty. Oh,
okay.
And that's really horrifying. And
I
was right.
It is a Kahlo. I could tell because of the wings on the hips, I guess.
Oh. That's cool.
Why are there
and then wings? You also have a dragonkin who's got little binoculars and a Vlaka who is enjoying the show with wine. As you do.
Yeah, Sarkeesian, you know.
Yes. All right. So here we are, the juice and potatoes. We've got like 12 minutes left in the episode. The juice and the potatoes.
That's not a saying I've ever heard.
It's chaos.
glass houses sink ships? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense. Of course a glass house would sink a ship. I know the Astrozoans were like your favorite one in this book. I'm going to allow you talk about your best friends.
Okay. Yeah. And they're also, I had a lot of stuff happen, so I did not get to read the book fully. And Astrozoans is about where I had to start skimming a lot after them. But mm-hmm. I love them. I love this art. This art is scary and creepy and it's great. They unleashed Astrozoans as opposed to first edition where you were just limited to, I believe it was humanoids that you could switch to do. And now it is just a creature, just another creature.
Very cool.
That makes it's a lot more usable.
Very cool. James cannot understate how cool and horrifying the art is in this section. Like, it describes what an Astrozoan shape changing is like. And there's this terrifying picture on page 131 of an Astrozoan shape shifting into like one of those three legged laser wolves. And it's like, oh my God, I'm just watching it like spaghetti its body and turn the spaghetti into different things.
Yep, it is complete body horror transformation, which is great. It's not just a magical puff or, you know, just turn around and it's a, you know, it's not dittoing itself. It's just like rending itself apart and putting itself back together. In fact, there's feats that do that to scare people.
Yeah, and on horrifying. It is horrifying. It very truly is. One thing that I'll say is one of the things I mentioned to James is, like, as somebody who is very into Kitsune, I've had like an eye on everything that can shape change in Pathfinder and Starfinder up to this point. And one of the funny things is that, like, a shape-shifting option will come out, and then the next one will be a little bit better because everyone agrees the first one wasn't good enough. And we've just seen a slow and steady increase in power. So, like, you have, I can't remember what they renamed Skinwalkers into, but that ancestry with, like, animal shape-shifting stuff, that one is, like, kind of it's not great. And then you have Kitsune, which is a little bit better, but it has some major problems in that you only get one of the two forms. You can either be a fox or a dude. If you choose a fox, you have to use the pest form stats, which means that foxes, which normally have a speed of 35 feet, you have a 10-foot speed in Pathfinder if you shapeshift into a fox. You're just the slowest fox ever. And then from there, you go to a Naughty who can shapeshift, but then just keep using the regular stats when they turn into a spider or a dude back and forth. So that one's a little bit better. And you just keep seeing the slow progression of things get better. And then you get to the Astrozoan where it's like, freedom! Yeah. Do whatever you want. It's very good. You transform into a small, medium, or large ancestry, you know, with any features you choose. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you could choose your body type, gender, other details within the normal range of that ancestry. You might resemble a specific individual or be completely unique. Like, it's like, oh, I could do whatever. Yep. And it's like, oh. So out of both of these games and, like, over 8 years of content, Astrozoans are officially the best at shapeshifting.
Yeah.
They did it.
Yeah. I mean, it's specifically their only thing. A lot of other shapeshifters have other things, like, as part of it. Well, you know?
It's funny. Kitsune have the same stat line as they do. Mm-hmm. Kitsune have 8 HP, medium, 25 feet. The only difference is that Kitsune only get charisma as an attribute boost, but they don't get the dexterity or the flaw. So, like, it's pretty comparable stat-wise. I'm actually hoping this is a trend towards just making shape-shifting maybe a little better so that it could do more in terms of being like a story mechanic. But we'll see going forward. Yeah. This gives me a lot of hope for that.
What I meant by differences is Kitsune has Japanese history and mythology slapped on top of it. Astrozoan is Patrick Star that is an assassin.
And so, you know what, like, if they limited Kitsune to that, that'd be fine. What I like about this and what I appreciate is just like how much it's just like, oh, we're not going to make shapeshifting something that makes you worse at something, you know. Like, it's just something cool you can do. So let's talk a bit about the there's a lot of cool stuff here. If you've been following Astrozoans from Starfinder Enhanced, there's not a ton here that's different from Starfinder Enhances portrayal of them. Like, there's not a ton of new information about them. It is a very succinct, very effective, very evocative, more efficient presentation of things we've already known about them. Would you agree with that?
There's
also, like, their list of beliefs, their popular edicts and anathema is really good. Let's talk about the mechanics, because I think mechanics is where Astrozoan shines.
Yes. Okay. What about mechanics?
I love their heritages. Basically, most of the heritages give them something to, like, focus what kind of Astrozoan they are. I think the most evocative one is probably the wild Astrozoan, which you only have one ancestry you can choose for shape change, but you could also use it to transform into animals with the statistics of pest form. You can pick any animal you want. And there are feats later in the book that let you do more complex animals, like the art that shows an Astrozoan transforming into a laser wolf, which is really cool. The Aquazoan, grade A pun, gives you more starfish abilities. You can swim, you can breathe water, that kind of thing. And that's baseline. That's not part of your shape-shifting. Mm-hmm. You also get the assimilated Astrozoan, which is basically you have grown up fully immersed in somebody's culture, pretending to be a member of them. You get to pick an ancestry, and you can choose feats from that ancestry because you have spent so much time as one that you are just better at pretending. That might be really fun in the future if you ever wanted to bring your Astrozoan back.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody would stand me and John Luke for that long.
Yeah. I would enjoy them. But then you even have, like, the construct copycat, where they learn to turn their bodies into constructs. And that's cool. Yeah. I love that. some of their feats. It includes stuff like learning, you choose an ancestry or heritage, you can pick a new language available to them and gain trained in society and in that ancestry's lore. You get cool stuff where you can have a physiology that's more like the ancient species that the Astrozoans likely were made from. Mm-hmm. You have abilities like Friendly Face, which is an uncommon feat that lets you shape change into a specific person as long as you've spent time studying them. There's reactive shapeshifting, where when an initiative roll triggers, you can shapeshift as part of the initiative roll. It's very cool. Mm-hmm. You can use restorative shapeshifting to heal yourself. You have suction cups as in your base form. It's just a really cool mix of base things you would expect a starfish to be able to do and base things you would expect a shapeshifter to be able to do.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I'm very impressed by this ancestry. I think that all of them are good, but this one is the best among equals.
Yeah, how about move on to the next one?
Let's do it. Let's talk about Contemplative, the big brains.
The big brains. I like the art on the next page that shows the accessibility features for really weirdly proportioned creatures. It has like a mount to hold this rocket launcher, and it has a vision sight. I don't think it has eyes.
But, oh, it must. The eyes are just so atrophied and inside the brain matter that you can't see them.
Yeah, but it definitely is a scatter that says something about its power level. But
definitely. I think it's really funny that they get a attribute bonus to charisma. I would have never thought the brains would have gotten that. Every contemplative I've ever met in a society has been a jerk.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, it's they're jerks that people go, "Yeah."
Yeah. I like them. They are fun because they have abilities that are also penalties in order to make up for the fact that they have a very good base array. You get low light vision. You get a vague sense called thought sense where you can detect things that can think, and you have limited telepathy at a range of 30 feet. But because you get three abilities compared to most ancestries getting fewer, you have an ability called atrophied. You decrease your maximum encumbered bulk limits by one. And you are clumsy one while using your hands to wield a weapon or device whose bulk is two or higher, which is amazing. Very good.
You're just a little guy. Just a little brain. It's hard for you.
I'm just a little guy. There's a lot of really cool feats for them, too. I like that one of them is the retrograde contemplative, which basically rarely by some genetic quirk, a contemplative like you is born with a body more closely resembling your less specialized ancestors, meaning it's not as atrophied. With longer, stronger limbs, you are still unmistakably a contemplative. You lose the atrophied trait and you gain 10 hit points from your ancestry instead of 6.
You're just a buff brain.
I'm the buffest brain. There's a lot of really fun abilities here. One of the ones I like is called Info Dump, where you are able to overwhelm a creature's mind with pointless trivia. I love it. You know me and Eon Hichihara. That is my jam.
That is the Mind Thrust City.
That is Mind Thrust City. Literally, if you attempt a roll to recall knowledge against the target, and if you pass, if you get a success, they're stupefied 1d6, and if you get a crit, they're stupefied 2 instead, which means they lose 2 actions. Very funny. Or no, that's a -2 penalty to a bunch of mental stat rolls. It's very good. All the brains are very cool, and I think since we are running low on time, let's skip to Dragonkin. Dragonkin are also great. Partner Bond is back from the original Starfinder First Edition. Notably, you can partner bond with any creature. It just says it's usually a non-Dragonkin, but if your partner bond is also a Dragonkin, you could do that in this edition where you couldn't previously. Sure. Most of the Dragonkin heritages are based around like generic, I'm better at this at being a dragon in this one specific way. And all of them are pretty reasonable. I think the weakest is probably Flameheart Dragon, which really all it does is like make you able to withstand hot temperatures a little bit better. But I like them.
I mean,
you do get cold resist. It's true. One of the things I really like about the Dragonkin article here is it talks a bit about how Dragonkin have sort of like they were magically created by dragons, but unlike most other dragon blood creatures, they're not just like other ancestries with dragon parts. Like they are their own species and nobody really knows how they did it. And a lot of their abilities talk about how like love and like connectivity and connection is really an important part of their culture, which is cool. I think that in terms of like feats, the dragonkin have fewer feats that made me go, wow, this is so cool. And like a lot of it is stuff like Heroes Last Stand, Fearsome, Magic Guardian.
Mood scales
is pretty funny because it basically means your scales are mood rings. Mm-hmm. I like that. My scales are mood rings. Aerial Dash is pretty cool. The big thing that they get is similar to Sheeran with the one heritage. They can just take feats to fly and they're very good at flying. And yeah,
they get a bunch of basically teamwork feats, things that they get better with doing other, but usually their bond, but also other allies.
Yeah, they get a lot of abilities that kind of make their partner bond stronger. So like if you're going to play a dragon, a dragonkin, you probably want to partner bond with another PC or a common NPC. Size of the Ancients is pretty cool. Once per day, you can grow too huge. Your equipment grows with you, which is fun. You just, I am the size of one of the actual dragons now. And then that's when you hear, oh my goodness, it's a dragon. Oh God, flame breath.
I do also like that the feat to get dragon breath is at first level. I appreciate that. Yeah. You can really get into the fantasy there.
Yeah, no, it's good. Like you can breathe fire right away. Like that's what people came for. They want to be able to breathe fire.
Yeah.
I missed it. Did you see if they get flight speed as a baseline thing or do they have to take a feat for it?
I believe they have to take a feat. Let me just double check.
I feel like the answer is yes. They have to take it. No, they have a speed of 20 feet and speed of 20 feet, just baseline. You can just fly. So you take that 1 feat and you could do everything that you expect a dragon to do. Just at first level. And I think this is something that the Starfinder ancestries, especially in this book, but overall have nailed very well. I think one of the big criticisms of second edition Pathfinder was like a lot of times you would kind of take apart an ancestry and you'd feel like, oh, I need to be level 5 to really feel like I'm this ancestry. But like, nah, Starfinder's like, here, have your cake, eat it. I'll watch you.
And then we have Kalos up next. The art really looks like it should have funk music behind it. PHONK funk music.
I love the one on 159 that's like the Mary Poppins Kalos.
yeah, that was just art that I wasn't expecting to see. It's good.
No.
I just because
all the other ones are like wearing like high-tech like sweat like water bubble suits to breathing. And this one's just like, oh, Mary Poppins. Very good.
Yeah, they have a bunch of cool Linorn connections. They get things like bioluminescence. They're, you know, your aquatic species, and the book's like, yeah, be careful about some of this stuff because it's for aquatics.
Yeah, it's very much like this is an underwater character. Some of this stuff won't do anything if your GM isn't going there. Be safe. Sarkeesians are large and in charge, and I feel for Sarkeesians because I feel like their energy wings is the one ability that'll almost never get used in a campaign.
And if it gets used, you get to be the hero once.
Once, yes, it's exactly.
Kind of also like suspended respiration. It's like, yeah, cool. They threw you out of the airlock and thought you were dead because they've never met one of you before and you survive.
It's true. Most of their other abilities are improving their flight, giving them like the ability to function in the void of space better. I feel like this is a little bit more applicable than the underwater abilities of the Kalos, but they very much fit into the same category of you need to be careful when you pick options here because there's a lot of stuff here that is a little too specific and may not come up very often. And that brings us to the final one, the best boys of the whole book, the Vlakas.
They're doing the meme. Shabby dooby dabby doo.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about this one is we've talked before about how most of the ancestry sections have added like a little bit more detail about what it's like to be a member of them, but not a whole lot of lore. The Vlaka one is very different because in the Vlaka one, we find out that like for somehow the Vlaka's son, which had been dying as a first edition, is suddenly just reignited for some reason. And like the main art shows them doing that meme because they are praising the sunlight coming back. Like this is a species where literally significant members of their species are born blind because there's not a ton of daylight. And that is something that's still here. They get an ability called sensory diversity where you can be blind, deaf, deafblind, or hearing sighted. I don't know if I like this trait. And the reason is that part of me feels like this should be general rules for playing a person with a disability rather than being specific to one ancestry. I think it's fine here, but I'm wondering if someone who is a bit more versed in the cultural like sensitivity of this would feel differently about it. And I'm interested to hear what people have to say about that. You can tell us on our Discord on nodirectionpodcast.com where you can click the Discord link and tell me all about what you think.
I some of the stuff is just like reed lips, which you get is would be a feat otherwise, something you could take. And also they're dog people, and a lot of the other senses are things that dogs kind of do better than people anyway.
That's fair enough. There's a lot of cool options. You can get a jaws natural attack as if you're sharp tooth. If you're nomadic, you get multilingual. You can get dark vision if you're a keen sighted Vlaka. There's an empathic one for getting bonuses, a sense motive, and you can have a winter coat to be really good on that frozen planet you live on.
I think the Vlaka art where he's just squaring up to fight somebody is very powerful. That made me respect Vlakas a lot more.
171, the blue and the guy in the blue one.
Yeah, he's ready to serve hands.
Yeah, honestly, all the Vlaka in this art are ready to fight, but that one is definitely the most threatening. He's like, I've got paws, and I'm not afraid. Yeah,
it's like the other ones are just, they kind of look like, I don't know. The thing that kind of makes me not like to play Vlakas is a lot of them look like people's OCs. And I don't, that's a lot of baggage I don't want to deal with at a table, man. But,
That's funny. I find it interesting that none of the art show them with tails. I didn't know they didn't have tails. Which is fine. It's something I noticed, you know. A lot of the art is very dog and or wolf or not art. A lot of the feats are very dog and or wolf coded. You've got stuff like cooperative, determined optimist. You have mediator, natural hunter. So like, there's a lot of options here. And I feel like compared to some of the other ancestries, especially the Astrozoans, they feel a little bit less focused here. Mm-hmm. There's just like a lot of dog.
A lot of dog stuff.
Yeah, which one of the options is funny. It's called guilt trip. You give your attacker a look of utter disappointment, so heartbreaking that it causes them to feel shame for their actions. I imagine that's just supposed to be the puppy stare, the puppy eyes.
Yeah. Also, menacing snarl, protect the pack. Like it really is a lot of dog wolf code.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that. I think it's probably fine, but I don't know. I wish it felt like it was a little bit more focused and visionary. And that's kind of how I feel about this and the Sarkeesians. And well, I mean, no, the Sarkeesians and the Kahlo are like too focused. Mm-hmm. And then the Vlaka are like too all over the place. And I feel like the Dragonkin and especially the Astrozoan are just like, here's a concept for what these people are. And here are feats that go with it. And like those two feel the best in my opinion, but I think all of them are good service.
Yeah. I also think a lot of these are good starting points, right? Like we're going to get more for these later on anyway.
Definitely. Do you have a favorite feat out of all these? Anyone?
That one where you're an Astrozoan and you rip your skin off to scare people.
Actually Kitsune Warlock in chat said mine. It's I'm the real one, which is when you're grappling someone, you shape change into a copy of them, and then you try to convince someone not to shoot you because you say I'm the real one.
That is pretty
very funny. Very funny. All right, so we've gone over this book, James. Mm-hmm. Big thoughts. What do you got?
I like it, and I think this is a more approachable than the previous versions of these type of books from first edition to give to new players. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a more approachable book than the first edition book, which is basically a big Bible gazetteer style book. I still like that book and I still want that book for second edition. But I think that when you're releasing a book before your core rule book, you can't scare them away.
Yeah,
and this book will not scare you away. This book will inspire you.
If something gets too complicated, you just go to the next section. The next section is only one or two pages away. True.
So Starfinder design team, I want the big Bible, but this book is pretty good as like a book that comes out before your core rule book.
Yeah.
But those are your thoughts. So James and I would love to hear yours. And if you want to give them, like I mentioned, hop to nodirectionpodcast.com. You can click our Discord link and hop into our Discord in order to give us your breakdown. What did you like about this book? What did you agree with us about? What did you disagree with us about? What did you really hate that I said here? Which opinion do I have that's just wrong? Tell me, tell me to my digital face. I'd love to hear it. We have a Starfinder chat. You can talk. You can talk to us. James and I are pretty good at responding. Our next episode is actually also going to be in June. It's going to be on June 25th. Topic to be decided. I don't really know. We have like two more big shows before we get to Starfinder's release. Like we have this one, and then we have the one at the end of July. So, what will we do? I don't know.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah, we always do. Mm-hmm. But until next time, because we'd love for you to come back and watch us figure it out. But mm-hmm. Until then, go beyond with no direction.